Hi, today is April 22nd, 2018, and this is MobiView Podcast number 251. This is the pre-end of the world podcast. For those of you who are not aware, there is a prediction that an as yet unknown planet, which is named somehow called Nibiru, or if you were a Japanese word, it'd be Nibiru, N-I-B-I-R-U, don't know how to pronounce it, is going to strike the world and end it tomorrow.
Well, and just we don't even know how to pronounce it because we've ignored it for so much that it's going to just show up and annoy us because we've ignored it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Any rate, so this 251 might be the last podcast, but if not, we'll be back next week.
Yeah, I'm going to go on record to say that we probably will.
We'll be back.
I'm going to make the bold prediction that the planet Nibiru is not going to strike Earth tomorrow.
Okay. Now, of course. You know, we don't know. It says April 23rd, but we don't know if it's our time zone, you know, our side of the international date line or the other. Because it's already April 23rd on the other side of the time, the international
date line. Yeah, but we know that planets, all solar systems understand that everything revolves around the United States.
That's right. It will strike first.
And likely the Eastern time zone.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. Most science fiction movies are like that. The ones that aren't invading Tokyo, anyway.
Yeah,
right? But those are mostly flying monsters. But anyway, so 251, last podcast. We'll see you next week. First up, speaking of needing some defending, so Microsoft released its Windows Defender browser protection for Google Chrome. Previously, it was only available for Edge, which I don't know. I don't use Edge, but the Windows Defender browser protection for Chrome sounds interesting. It's supposed to add protection from phishing attacks. And I think Chrome already has some phishing attack protection. So this is supposed to give you some additional protection. I think I'll install it.
You know, this
just to see how it is.
Reminding me, talking about phishing attacks, of a Reddit shower thoughts thread from yesterday that said... we grew up, it was speaking about millennials, and it was, we grew up with our parents telling us to be wary of the internet and all the dangers lurking on it, and then they got on the internet and fell for every single one of them. And so if you find yourself often accidentally falling for phishing attacks and things like that, you should probably look into this Windows Defender browser protection.
Yeah, yeah. If you're very young or very old, you're probably the target audience.
Yes.
Yeah. But it couldn't hurt. Well, I shouldn't say that because Chrome extensions often do hurt, you know, in terms of performance and other things. So I guess we'll have to wait and see. I have not yet installed it, but I do plan to just to play with it a bit. Or I guess you don't play with it. You just kind of, you know.
Randomly find some phishing sites.
Go. Yeah. Go to a phishing site on purpose. That'd be super smart.
All right. I will admit to, in the past, being so annoyed by some phishing sites that I've gone and just put in garbage information and profanity and other random things. It makes me feel a little better if anyone ever has to look through that to go, oh, well,
here's someone. Put in your local FBI office's phone number as your contact. Yeah. But at any rate, next up is another Microsoft thing, and I'm kind of upset by this one. So in the tech community blog, Office 365 Microsoft blog, so it's officially sourced. It says that beginning with Office 2019, which is going to be released this year, OneNote for Windows, or OneNote 2016, which is the Windows application, is going to be the last of its kind. And if you want to use the current version of OneNote, you have to use OneNote for Windows 10 from the Windows Store. Now, OneNote for Windows 10 from the Windows Store currently exists, and it's terrible.
Yeah,
it lacks so many features that's available in the full OneNote 2016. So, you know, I never use it.
Yeah, I'm curious about this and the idea that the default OneNote experience. What exactly does that mean? That you will not be able to easily install OneNote 2016 if you are in Office 365. And I use OneNote for one particular purpose, and that is to create curriculum manuals for the programs that I run. And my instructors find it very nice to have what looks like an old-time paper analog, in a sense, sections and pages and all that. So I use OneNote for that, and I would be kind of annoyed if I couldn't use OneNote 2016 Although, thankfully, for most of my personal note-taking, I'm still using Evernote, or I've gone to kind of a hybrid of Evernote, and then, this is going to sound really ancient, file folders and text files in those files.
Wow, what a concept.
I know.
I hope those text files and folders are in some kind of cloud-based
service.
Okay. Now, but here's the interesting thing to me, and I'd be interested what you have to say about this. So in the second paragraph of the Office 365 blog that talks about this change, it says, why OneNote for Windows 10? I wonder that too. And the answer is, the app, you know, this is the Windows Store version, OneNote for Windows 10. The app has improved performance and reliability, and it's powered by a brand new Sync engine, which we're also bringing to the web, Mac, iOS, and Android. You needn't worry about being on the latest version since it's always up to date. You know, basically, to me, it sounds like it sucks less. So come on over.
Yeah.
You know, it's still not good.
All those really annoying features that weren't working all that well, we just got rid of all of them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, sucks less.
Sucks less. I mean, you know. So, yeah, come over from the superior current version.
I do wonder if anyone ever worries about not being on the most current version. Because that wording just, I don't think there are regular users staying up late at night going, am I on the latest version of OneNote? No.
In fact, my this is just, you know, I don't, it's not a scientific study. There's no statistics behind it. But my observation is that most regular people who use a computer could care less what version they're on as long as it works. And
yeah, I agree with that.
And in fact, they're kind of afraid of a new version because it might mean they have to relearn stuff or change the way they do things, you know, change their workflow. So I would say most people not only are not actively seeking the latest version, they're kind of dreading it because change is bad, you know, from the point of view of somebody who's learned to do something over the course of years and now has to unlearn it and learn a new way to do something potentially. But any rate, you can start using OneNote for Windows today. Yeah, okay, fine. I'm not planning to, until I'm forced to, I guess. But and it says, for many of you, shifting our focus to Windows 10 app won't come as a surprise. Well, actually, it surprised me. aside from a handful of targeted improvements, we haven't added any new features to OneNote 2016 in some time. And like I said, for most people, that is great.
Yeah,
they probably,
and you haven't added really any new features to OneNote for yeah. Windows 10 either.
Yeah. Yeah.
Including those features that are in OneNote for 2016.
Yeah. Yeah. Instead, we've been focusing on consistency, ensuring that nearly all your favorite features in OneNote 2016 are also available in OneNote for Windows 10. We're almost there, and in the coming months, we'll be adding even more top-requested features. In other words, it's still subpar as of today. You know, still can't do everything you can do in the full, what I call the full OneNote 2016 application. And then there's a list of stuff they need to put in, like insert and search for tags, view and edit files, duh. Additional class notebook features, which, well, could affect you. It doesn't affect me. Improve sync, improving user experience. I'm afraid of that improved user experience. And does say OneNote for Windows 10 will be included in all versions of Office 365, including Pro Plus, around the same time 2019's release. So, and they just renewed, they auto-renewed my personal Office 365 account, so I guess I'll be seeing this insanity soon enough. Okay, that's my rant.
Well, next is something that I am really hoping is true.
Okay.
I couldn't care less if Microsoft decides to bring OneNote 2019, 2016, 20 Windows 10, whatever. I care about something I've wanted for about 4 years now, and that is custom watch faces for the Apple Watch.
Seriously?
I remember at launch wanting this feature and hoping this feature would be there, and with every version of Apple Watch OS, I've been hoping to be able to get either the ability to create my own watch faces, which I suppose if developers could do, I could do since I have a developer account, or just the option to look at what cool watch faces others would come up with.
You know,
and
yeah, go ahead.
This week, in one of the latest Watch OS SDK betas, there's at least a glimmer of hope. An area in one of the compiler instruction sets that says this is where the bundle for custom watch faces would go. So hopefully that means Apple's thinking about this and perhaps we'll show it off as early as WWDC this year.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, because after my my beloved Spot Watch service is turned off, I didn't have a watch for a number of years. And when I finally did choose a smartwatch, I went with the Android Wear Moto 360 because of two things. One, it was a lot less expensive than an Apple Watch. And two, it did have or does have custom watch faces, and some of them are quite good. I know I've spent a couple of bucks on getting really nice third-party watch faces. They're also free ones, but I've paid a couple of bucks for watch faces on the Moto 360 Android Wear. And I really appreciated it. You know, the only thing we can do on our watch, and I switched to Series 3 because Android Wear wasn't going anywhere. The only thing we can do on an Apple Watch is select your own photo and place a couple of things on top of it. I guess you call them complications on the watch. But you can't really design a watch face like a chronometer or something like that.
And for me, there's really only, because I've never really liked the look of an analog watch.
Yeah.
There's really only a couple of watch faces I end up using. The complex, the modern, whatever it's called that has all the little complications.
Right.
And the Siri watch face are really the only two that I use. And I don't even use Siri on the Siri watch face. I replace her with the weather and just use the cards.
Yeah. And for me, I just use a custom photo. Mm-hmm. And it has the date, time, and weather. And that's it. I'd like to have more. I might be able to get more, but that's about all I can do.
Well, this is the beginning of rumor season for Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference, which occurs in early June each year. So we are starting to see some things trickle out, and I'm hoping that watchOS 5 and iOS 12 and macOS, whatever is after High Sierra, will have some interesting new features and some interesting things that we find useful. Which sort of segues into the next topic. One of the things that's been rumored.
I was going to add one more thing.
Okay.
I hope those new features are backwards compatible with our Series 3 watches and not only available in Series 4 or whatever they call it.
I assume they will be. Apple for the Apple Watch has been pretty good about most changes go as far back as possible with even the fact that I still have an Apple Watch Series 0 over here, the original Apple Watch. And there are very few things that I notice a difference between the two. Occasionally I'll switch on and off between them.
Yeah.
And the experience is pretty much the same. There are some technical, you know, increases with the Series 3.
Yeah.
But I don't think we're going to see Series 4 only features in the same way that we see, you know, iPhone 10 only features and things like that.
Right. Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead with your next item.
Well, the next item is a small one that's starting to get some play, and that's the idea of cross-platform macOS/iOS apps, with some saying that Apple should just ditch macOS and bring iOS. Yeah, I hate that idea.
Bad idea.
That seems to be something that Apple itself is saying, yeah, that's a bad idea. So in a rare moment, Apple's actually agreeing with us.
Yeah.
But also, just this idea of, I'm trying to think of a situation where I'd want the exact same experience on macOS as I have on iOS. And I can't really think of too many because it seems like the interfaces are fundamentally different. So the way you build an app for touch versus the way you build an app for mouse and keyboard seem to be a little bit different. And so I'm very skeptical about cross-platform. Is it something that we really want or need? There are some things I'd love to have from iOS on macOS, including HomeKit control and stuff like that. But in terms of true cross-platform apps widely available, I'm not sure how useful that would be. And I worry that in some cases it would be similar to what we're seeing with Office or OneNote 2000 or OneNote 2016 and OneNote for Windows 10, where basically OneNote for Windows 10 is built to be the more cross-platform app.
Right.
And it's lacking a whole bunch of features. And I worry that if we had the same thing with macOS iOS, you'd get these iOS apps that are really great on iOS, but really underpowered on macOS.
Yeah, you know, the only thing I can think of that might be useful to have, and I'm just kind of thinking this through real quickly, is it might be nice to have some of the photo apps from iOS, because there's really nothing. Well, there are comparable things, but they're much more expensive on macOS. And, you know, like, I'm thinking about things like Camera Plus, those kind of applications, or Prisma, you know. Mm-hmm. So that might be nice to have, but honestly, I don't really care. I mean, it doesn't matter to me. And I'll give you another, I'll give you an example of something that I thought was a super duper idea, and it turns out, and it's not a bad idea, it's just that it didn't really turn out the way I thought, and that is this. When I bought my Chromebook last year, and it's been a year now since I've gotten it, I think. When I brought my Samsung Chromebook Plus, the main reason is it was the first Chromebook to be shipped with native support for Android apps from the Google Store. And I thought, you know, and I'd literally been waiting for that to be, you know, in production. Because I thought, well, Chromebook, eh, you know. But if it had Android apps, oh, yeah, it'd be super. It turns out I hardly ever use Android apps on it. The Chrome is just fine all by itself. I would say probably the only thing I use on it might be the Google TV and movies player app. And that's kind of broken on the Chromebook right now. You can't download movies. You were able to a few months ago. Now it doesn't. But other than that, Evernote doesn't work so well when you bring it to Android version. So, you know, that was kind of a disappointment. I would probably use that if it were available. There's some Paint apps, but, you know, not critical. And if I didn't have an iPad, it'd be critical. So it turned out that the need for mobile apps on a notebook-like platform wasn't a big deal. But, well, mostly because Google Chrome is a very powerful, more than a browser, it's really a platform. It's really an app platform. So, yeah, I really hate that idea of replacing macOS with iOS completely in desktop. That just seems like a bad idea to me.
Yeah, and that's, I think, the same thing that Apple's basically thinking as well. But we'll see. I like the idea of some cross-platform. I like things that make it easy for developers, perhaps, to have macOS and iOS in the same bundle in terms of code, so that you would just have one thing to distribute. But in terms of cross-platform that looks the same on both, I don't think that's a great idea.
Yeah, I was just kind of trying to think of, you know, apps I use on the iPhone that might be nice to have on a desktop. And the, you know, one I can think of maybe are some of like Flixster, you know, to check for movie times and stuff. Boy, and then the list gets short. Maybe some of the weather apps like Dark Sky, but you can't really, you know.
The irony is a lot of the apps, looking at my iPhone, a lot of the apps that I use on iOS already have a macOS version that's very nice.
So it's not a big deal.
So, yeah, Tweetbot, To-Do, Fantastical, Reader. Yeah, I can get those. Those all have nice versions on macOS already.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, and next up is something you found, which I found interesting since you're not a Google Fi subscriber.
Well, yeah, I did notice this Project Fi that Todd is a subscriber to, and I am not, but I've been tempted by in the past, is celebrating its birthday. And to do that, it is offering, or Google is offering, $150 off a Pixel 2 XL. Mm-hmm. And initially when I saw this, I thought, ooh, that's tempting, because I thought about getting a Pixel, and then I realized this is the Pixel 2 XL. Yeah,
with all the problems.
It's not just the Pixel 2. If I would like the Pixel 2, I'm not getting any discounts. So I'm not interested, but if you are a fan of the Pixel 2 XL and you would like a bigger phone, and this is a pretty nice deal. $150 off. It takes you from $999 down to $849.
Yeah, and which means I got to process this podcast fast, because it expires. What did I say? It expires today at 11 p.m. Pacific.
Well, so, if you missed it, we're sorry, but don't worry, the world's ending.
That's right. So I was going to say they timed it. Yeah, so they get your money before the world ends, because, you know, that's how Google works.
Well, that planet, if you pay it enough money, it'll go away.
Yeah, it could.
And you can give it all to the prophets that are saying that it's showing up. You just give them all that money, and they'll pay off the planet.
Yeah. And, you know, and even if you did miss it, because, you know, we posted it kind of the day it expired. not to worry, because Google's been promoting the Pixel phones pretty heavily over the past year. And
yeah, maybe they'll do a deal like this for the Pixel 2.
Yeah. And the other thing to remember is maybe you don't want to buy a Pixel 2 or Pixel 2 XL right now, because it is April, and if Google is true to form, they're going to announce a new Pixel 3 or some other, you know, follow-up to the device this fall, which is when they That's normally... True. So, you know, this is basically getting rid of stock. Mm-hmm. And because Android devices do not have the kind of long upgrade cycle that iOS devices do. You know, iOS devices got upgraded, 4 or 5 years after it's released? Mm-hmm. Android devices typically don't get upgrades after year two, 24 months. And the Pixel 2 was, Pixel 2 and 2 XL were released, 9 months ago or whatever. So it's, you know, almost halfway through its cycle, its upgrade cycle. And the reason I mentioned that is that happened to me when I bought what preceded the Pixel? The Nexus. When I bought the Nexus 6, I bought it in the middle of its cycle. I bought it in the summer of 2015, I think. And so, you know, in the Pixel, originally the Pixel 1, let's call it. The Pixel 1 was released 1 year later. I was already halfway through my upgrade cycle. And when the Pixel 1 was released, my upgrade cycle was done. Even though my device was only, from my point of view, only 1 year old.
You were Pixel out of luck.
Yeah. So, you know, you got to be careful. Whereas iOS devices, boy, you get upgrades. Like I said, 4 or 5 years, I think, John, that sounding about right?
Yeah, that's about right. You, at least in some form, you get something. So. Yeah.
Okay. And the last item, Sven Johansson, who was on our podcast last week, I actually chatted with him about this a bit. And that is that BT, which used to stand for British Telecom, but now I think it's just BT. It's like, you know, IBM doesn't stand for International Business Machines. It's just IBM. So BT is planning to turn off its public switch telephone network, the PSTN, and switching entirely to VoIP over the next couple of years. Personally, I mean, I know why they're doing it. You know, it's much more efficient to run a network that way. But personally, I think it's a bad idea. You know, Sven has VoIP to his home through probably his cable company or something. And he said, well, you know, we have, you know, and my question to him was, well, how the heck are you going to power this thing when the power goes out? And he says, well, you know, they do supply UPS in the home for the device. So it does keep powered up for, you know, I don't know how long it keeps it powered up. And UPS is, at least for high wattage devices like PCs, typically only keep it up for 15, 20 minutes. You know, enough time to save files and shut down. But on a lower, you know, lower power draw device like a phone, which presumably might draw, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 watts, you know, presumably could keep it up for longer. But still, you know, if you have a really bad situation, like you're down. And we've had power off for like half a day, a full day, because of various storms and things here, earthquakes. You're probably out of luck. And the other thing is, you have to wonder how much power they're going to supply to the neighborhood nodes or whatever it is that you connect your VoIP phone to on the other end. You know, right now, when power goes off, the telephone company's public switch telephone network powers your phone through the telephone lines. There's a 48-volt, you know, power flowing through that in addition to the actual voice signaling. So when power goes out, you notice that if you have an old school phone, it will ring. You can talk to somebody, you know, somewhere, and it will generally stay powered on for the duration. Phone companies typically have diesel trucks fueling and to refuel their central offices to keep the generators there going, to keep the telephone system up, even in, you know, total blackout situation, extended blackout situations. But you have to wonder if they're going to do the same kind of thing for a, you know, VoIP system. And I'll give you a story. So in my office, we have a VoIP system. And one day we came in and nothing worked. And power was on. That wasn't the problem. The power problem was the UPS had died and took down the entire VoIP system, you know, at our end, right, at the customer end. So, you know, we had to call the phone company using a cell phone and have them walk across the street, because we're across the street from the phone company. But actually, they didn't walk across the street, because they deploy their trucks from a base yard that's miles away. And the guy didn't bring the UPS with him, since he had, you know, we didn't know what the problem was. There was no diagnostics that we could do at our end. So it was kind of a hassle, in my opinion. I mean, you know, VoIP is, is easier to manage from a network point of view. And, you know, you can, well, not easier. I should say it's more efficiently managed, and you can get a lot more voice traffic on it if you manage it properly. But I don't know. I'd be kind of concerned if they, you know, the whole country is going to decide to shut down their PSTN in favor of VoIP.
It's a level of redundancy that there's nothing to step in and take the place of.
Yeah.
If we had, so right now you figure the typical household has three lines of utilities coming in that carry data of some sort, so cable, telephone, and electricity.
Yeah.
Well, you can run data over electricity.
Yeah.
And you can run telephone over data, and you can do all those things, but you can't run easily electricity over cable.
Yeah. There is power over Ethernet, but that's limited to 100, to about 100 meters.
Yeah. So if there was other redundant way for this to go, then I'd say I don't see any problem, but there really isn't. You turn off PSTN and you've got someone who's just got a cable coming into their house and their power goes out. They might have data coming through the cable, but they don't have power to access it.
Yeah.
And if the cable line goes out, you might have power, but you don't have any way to run your voice over IP phone if there's no data connection.
Yeah.
So
now a lot of young people are probably looking at this and going, why do we even care? You know, they don't even have a wired phone in their home, but being an old school telephone guy, I know how long, and by actual life experience, I know how long the backup, the UPS in the local cell towers around me will last. It's 12 hours, by the way, because I timed it when we had an extended blackout, and exactly 12 hours after the blackout started, all cell phones stopped. And I mean everything, because at the time I had Sprint, Verizon, and AT&T. I don't think I had T-Mobile at the time. No, yeah, AT&T. And all three stopped working about the same time. So that was interesting.
And here's a random psychological question, but I'm curious if I'm the only one that does this or not.
Yeah.
So sitting at your desk, you have an office phone.
Okay.
And you have your cell phone with you all the time. Yep. Now, you've got other people at your office that you are probably able to contact either via their office phone or a cell phone or both. You can choose which one you want to use.
Right.
Do you find it seems less burdensome to pick up your office phone, dial an extension, and talk to them versus picking up your cell phone, finding their contact information, and hitting their name?
I would say so. But one of the reasons I pick up the office phone is because we can dial 5 digits for inside the enterprise to reach almost everybody, not quite everybody. Some people are outside of the CentraNet or Centrex system that we use.
But at the same time, if you have someone in your phone book on your phone, it's probably less than 5 taps to find them and hit their. I was thinking about this the other day because I read an article this morning that one of my friends posted that's in the Chronicle of Higher Education. And it was about a dean's office, I think University of Michigan, changing their email policy, trying to reduce the number of emails they sent out. And they said something along the lines of, if it's a simple thing that you just need to talk to someone over, use the phone. Don't send an email. Even during working hours, pick up the phone and call.
Hmm.
And I thought, that's something that is much faster in many cases, just picking up the phone and calling than sending an email and waiting on a response. But yet, for some reason, if I'm at my office phone and it's right there and I can just pick it up and hit a couple buttons and it connects almost instantly, that's less of a bar than having to pick up my cell phone, which is sitting right next to it, wait for it to connect, and talk to someone that way. It's a weird psychological thing about you're doing the same action, but in one case it's slightly faster, and it seems more acceptable than in the other case.
Okay, now I have a question for you, and it's a cultural thing that might be age related. Not sure. Might even be related to where you are in the nation. Not even sure about that. But do you feel, given a choice, again, like you said, given a choice between calling a person's desk phone and calling the cell phone, and you know both numbers, which one are you more likely to call during the workday for a work-related question?
If I am at my desk, I'm more likely to call their desk phone.
Me too.
Because it's phone-to-phone. If I'm not at my desk, I'm actually probably about equally likely to call either their work number or their personal number, because it's just whatever was probably most recent in my call log.
Right. And the reason I do it, by the way, is might be old school, might be an age-related thing, is because I figure if you're sitting at your desk, you're kind of more able to deal with a phone call, an incoming phone call. If I call your cell phone, you might be in a meeting, you might be in the restroom, you might be in a number of situations where it is not convenient for you to pick up the phone, or driving, you know, any of those things, right? Now, I know a lot of people, especially millennials, it doesn't matter. You know, all I have is a cell phone. So just call my cell phone. You know, I'm fine with that. And a lot of people do tell me that, even they're not millennials. But on the other hand, you know, I figure if I call your desk phone, if you have one, you're more likely to be able to carry on a, you know, 3-minute conversation than you are on a cell phone where you're rushing around, walking around, driving around, whatever it is you're doing in the middle of a meeting. And I hate it when people pick up their phones in the middle of a meeting, and unless it's an emergency.
Well, it is interesting to think psychologically about what we, our relationship with a ringing phone.
Yeah.
Prior to caller ID, a ringing phone always interrupted your life.
Yeah.
You know, you always, you prioritized it. If the phone rang and you were talking with someone, they understood completely when you reached over and picked up, et cetera. Yeah. Now with caller ID, I think people are just now starting after 10, 20 years of having this in wide availability to go, okay, that's so-and-so, I'll call them back.
Yeah.
And not feel like the incessant need of, oh, so-and-so's calling, I better immediately pick up. You know, most people have figured out, well, if it's important, they'll call back again, or they'll leave a voicemail. Otherwise, they'll just understand that I'll call them when I get a chance.
Okay.
But it's almost taken a while for that understanding to seep out.
Okay, now here's another thing for which I have no data. It's just an observation. And in just maybe the culture, you know, that's hyper-local to my area. But I've noticed that young people are more likely to pick up phone in any situation than older people. You know, and by older, I mean, let's say 30 plus. They're more likely to be selective and, you know, actually looking at that incoming number and decide, yeah, it's important. No, it's not important.
That's interesting. I don't know if that might be the case. I do know one of the things I found very interesting is that hyper-local to me, it seems like in my area of the country, in the Mississippi Delta, phone calls are still somehow seen as more preferable, even if something would better be done over email.
Now, that's interesting.
I'll give you an example. We'll often have people call the university, and just these phone calls will take the kind of form of, hey, I'm interested in some information about your program.
Yeah.
Well, okay, well, what program? Well, then they're not quite sure. Okay, so then you spend a few minutes trying to figure out exactly what program they're thinking about, and then all this other stuff. And I think, you know, if you just emailed me, I would have sent you back all this information.
Yeah.
But now we're going through a 20-minute phone call for what could have been literally a 2-minute email course.
Or if you had looked at our website first.
Well, yeah. And it's sort of an interesting thing because it's still seen, I think, by some in various pockets of the country, that if you want to get something done, you call. Whereas in reality, in most business situations now, getting something done doesn't require a phone call. It just requires communication of some sort.
Yeah. Although, you know, I found that when you do need to get something done, you want to call, there's often no one to call.
Sometimes that is true.
Yeah. Or it's very difficult to identify who that person is. Like, for example, if you need to get something done with Apple. Or Google, for that matter. Or Facebook. Or any of the, you know, .com type companies. I guess Apple's too old to be a .com company, but you know what I mean. Techie companies. Mm-hmm. In fact, that happened the other day. What was it? It was like needing to activate the new iPad, and there was some problem with the existing Apple customer ID, and I couldn't figure out what was going on, so I told the person, you just better call Apple. Then I had to go find a number to call. But once we called Apple, the tech support guy was able to help that person really fast, so and resolve, you know, something I didn't know what to do. So that worked out. Okay, that's about all I have. John, you have anything else?
I think I'm all good. We never podcast again, it's been a pleasure podcasting with you.
It's been fun. 251 for me, of which you've been on almost 200 of them now. Like
I've been on much of the majority of them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, hopefully this planet just goes away, goes somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're kind of hoping the world doesn't end tomorrow, April 23rd. But if it does, well, it's been nice knowing you all, and thanks for listening. Yeah. Yeah. And depending on what happens on April 23rd, we'll talk to you next time. Or not. Or not. All righty. Signing off from 251.